for tuning in to 96.3 Ohm Radio Charleston. I'm Whitney Powers, and I'm your host today for the series Small Talks, Big Ideas, a weekly half-hour plus or minus show that is a collaborative space shared by four of our community's advocacy organizations, including Lowcountry Local First, Coastal Conservation League, the Sustainability Institute, and If You Were Mayor. That's us. That's me. And while these organizations serve different needs in our community, they are largely aligned in their vision for the future. So Small Talks, Big Ideas is a space for each of these organizations to share their ideas, have tough but necessary conversations, and invite you as listeners into our work. For today's segment, we welcome Michelle Mapp, CEO of the South Carolina Community Loan Fund. Hello, Michelle.
Hello, Whitney.
The South Carolina Community Loan Fund, which we will refer to as SCCLF as we go forward, is a community development financial institution with a mission to building communities in South Carolina, primarily through its loan programs aimed at affordable housing, healthy food, and community facilities. The SCCLF is an advocate in each of these areas as well, and we invited you to talk to us today specifically about the dilemma facing the Lowcountry related to the lack of affordable housing. Our goal is to speak to this issue maybe as a kind of story where we've been, where we might be able to go with this moving forward, and the implications maybe of where we are heading if we ignore the issue or kick the can down the road, as it were. So full disclosure, I've been a member of the SCCLF board since 2007, and this is my last year. I'm going to take full advantage of every moment. And so Michelle, I just for our listeners, why don't you give them kind of a brief history and maybe an introduction, your elevator pitch for the South Carolina Community Loan Fund.
Sure. So our organization was founded 11 years ago, originally called the Charleston Housing Trust. We grew out of what was then known as the Mayor's Council on Homelessness and Affordable Housing. And that organization, seeing that between 1990 and 2000, there was a 100% increase in the price of housing on the peninsula.
Whoa.
So imagine if you bought a house for $100,000 in 1990, you could sell it for $200,000 in 2000. And so the mayor, recognizing that federal and state dollars to support affordable housing were shrinking, really was looking for a local solution to address affordable housing development. So he tasked this working group out of the mayor's council to go look and see what was happening around the country and then report back. That group, headed up by Vince Graham, came back to the city of Charleston and said, "We think you should start a separate nonprofit local housing trust fund whose mission would be twofold. One, to provide capital for the development of affordable housing because we had a supply issue, and two, to reduce regulatory barriers that were preventing the development of affordable housing." And so the mayor agreed, and our organization started.
Off and running.
Off and running. And so fast forward, here we are 11 years later.
Here we are 11 years later. And maybe before we go forward, the best thing is maybe to talk a little bit about what affordability means, and maybe even how you've mentioned briefly how that compares to in a decade, for instance, some of the issues that have arisen with just the value of housing, it seems to be a very broad definition these days, at least in Charleston.
Yes, yeah, so affordable housing is a relative term. So the sort of official U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development definition of affordable housing says regardless of what your income is, so whether you make $1 million, whether you make $10,000, if you're paying more than 30% of your monthly income on housing, then your housing's considered unaffordable. So,
or you're living beyond your means.
Or you're living beyond your means, right. So for a renter, that would include rent and utilities. And then for a homeowner, that's principal, interest, taxes, and insurance.
Okay.
So it's possible for someone who makes $1 million a year to be living beyond their means because a significant amount of their monthly income is going to their housing. So right. That's sort of the sort of formal kind of federal definition of what's affordable housing. But then there's affordable housing programs. So we have programs across the country, and most of those programs have more to do with the amount of money a household makes. And so it has to do with something called area median income.
Right.
And so for our Tri-County, the area median income is about $65,000. So that means one half of our population makes more than 65, one half makes less. Affordable housing from a programmatic standpoint, then from the federal government side, means households that make 80% or more of that 65,000. Okay. And it adjusts based on household size. So when we're talking about affordable housing, a general rule of thumb that we tell people to kind of bring it home, no matter who you are, take your annual income,
right,
multiply it by 3, and that should tell you roughly how much of a house you could afford to buy. So if I make $50,000, affordable is roughly about $150,000, give or take, interest rates, down payments, right, a lot of right. other things. And so in our market, where you have on the peninsula, where we're seeing average price and median price homes reaching $600,000, $700,000,
right.
we have Mount Pleasant right now that's, you know, $400,000, $500,000. And then even just regionally, we're well above $200,000, $250,000 average and medians when our incomes are, you know, half of our population makes $65,000
right.
or less.
Right.
So there's a disconnect between what's available and what people can afford. And in some markets, the issue has more to do with kind of the cost of housing or the cost of land and, you know, those things. In our market, that's part of the issue, but we've spent a lot of time over the last 11 years looking at it, and we really have a supply issue here.
Right,
so
right.
there are not enough housing units. So for what we do have, there's high demand, and that demand is what's pushing prices higher and higher.
So we don't have what we don't have enough, and what we have is expensive.
Yes.
Well, you know, I mean, it's been an issue for a long time. There was a time in Charleston when there was affordable housing that was basically integrated into the downtown historic fabric. I mean, I remember when I moved here in 1988 that you would see that. And over time, you know, they're just have seemed to be or has been such a transition. And in fact, there have been waves, even predating that, waves when affordable housing units, relatively speaking, were demolished for various reasons. The original construction of the Gilliard Auditorium demolished a number. There was the Anson Fields issue where a number of units were demolished. There was the construction of the Crosstown, which
divided
the city. And then we've had even recently the loss of the relatively inexpensive units in the Sergeant Jasper. And then now I understand there's a hotel slated at Meeting Street near the Visitor Center where there are a few hundred more of those relatively affordable units that we're losing. And then, you know, 2 weeks ago or within the last couple of weeks, there was an opinion piece in the Post and Courier where the commentator was talking about, the remaining public housing downtown really should be demolished and replaced with market rate units. And I read that sort of with disbelief because I thought, holy cow, I mean, there must be a certain deja vu among the African-American population for even that notion to be floated and published. And you have an incredible amount of expertise and a willingness to take a stand on these kinds of things, and to carry water, as it were. Would you care to maybe share some insight? I mean, about this kind of story, or where we are, and what that story is telling us.
Sure. So, first of all, I think that we have to acknowledge that housing, particularly housing for lower income households in our country, has a certain stigma.
Okay.
That we have not been able to move away from. We also have to acknowledge that every day our government invests in certain aspects of our community, and that we've become very comfortable with the idea of local governments, or, you know, county or state governments creating infrastructure in terms of roads, or helping to build a park, or making those investments. We do not feel that same way about housing traditionally as a community. So we do not see housing, particularly housing for low-income people, as a business that local government should be in.
Right, right.
But if you think about it, our cities are about people. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, particularly in a city like Charleston, that's such a tourism-rich city, very service-oriented, think about all of the restaurants, think about all of the hotels, all of the retail. All of those businesses run based on the people who work there.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
And so we have to think about where those people live. And when we don't, what we have is traffic congestion.
Right.
We have people commuting from, you know, Somerville and Monk's Corner to come work downtown Charleston. We have a diminished quality of life for us all. We have a disconnect between communities and the schools that operate within those communities. And somehow we've managed to see this all as sort of separate, disparate issues, and never taken the time to really think about how this all fits
right
together.
That is really part of the conundrum, is the fact that you know, education, transportation, and safe housing are all interlocked.
Yes.
And you can't solve for one without solving for all three. And they're all investments. They're all community investments.
Yes.
That we all can benefit from, as you say. And it really does touch on the spectrum of people. I mean, you know, they're senior citizens that are left out. You know, these are not just poor people, but they're senior citizens who face challenges. We certainly see young professionals and you know, young families that face these challenges regardless of kind of what their jobs are. They've got daycare issues. They've got you know, where to live within some proximity. I know we hear it quite often, local businesses talking about an inability to find people that with the skill set to work in the jobs that are they can't bring people here because the people can't afford to live here. So these are and you've mentioned some factors that seem to complicate, you know, that it's kind of an unwillingness to actually even have the conversation, I guess, in some ways.
And if you think about it, you know, we often talk about housing in terms of a ladder. So if you think of a ladder and, you know, it has 12 rungs, and to get to the top ladder, you have to be able to climb up. And so if you think about each rung on the ladder as a certain income level.
Right.
And that very bottom rung, or basically the ground, would be homelessness, people who don't have
right.
sort of any income. Well, what we've we are creating in our community is a ladder where sort of the first five or six rungs are missing, you know? And so in order to climb onto the ladder, you got to be able to step up really, really high.
It's like those fire escapes in New York,
right,
where you can't
to even be able to get on there. And so what happens is that whenever there's sort of a change in the economy, it places pressure kind of down on the rungs below. So if I'm at a certain level and I can no longer afford my, you know, single family home in Mount Pleasant and I need to sell and move down to something else, it places pressure on those bottom
right.
rungs, particularly if there's not enough housing units at those price points to
right.
be able to address. And we, you know, people will try to make it the argument like it's really hard and it's really complicated and there's some sort of special math to be able to make, you know, housing that's less affordable. But it's really, in the grand scheme of things, no different than going to Starbucks and, you know, you have your tall, you have your grande, you have your
right.
It's all coffee. It just comes in a different size container. Or if you have your, you know, Honda Civic, Honda Accord, you know, different, you know, it's still just housing. And yes, it's expensive housing, but what do we need to do to be able to produce those units? Well, we know.
Right.
We know what needs to happen to lower the cost to produce housing. You need higher densities.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
You have to figure out how you can lower the cost. So if I'm creating one house on 1 acre, you know, there's a cost to that.
Right.
If I'm creating five houses on 1 acre, the cost is going to be split five ways. If
right.
I'm creating 10 houses on 1 acre. And so understanding that it's not rocket science, it's
right.
sort of basic math of supply and demand. And I think where people get afraid of density is that we have sort of these visions in our mind of bad density. And there's been lots of examples of bad
right.
density. But that's more about bad design
right.
than anything. And we have total control over design. We can say this is what we visually like and what's appealing and
right.
what fits into the character without saying that we got to throw out density because somehow that's a bad thing. Or we have this notion, you know, we have traffic today.
Right.
So if we build 10 more apartments tomorrow, that somehow that's impacting traffic that we already have today. No, something has already created the bad traffic that we have now.
Oh, yes.
Let's think about what that is. I would say that it has more to do with the fact that we have an overwhelming number of single-family, auto-dependent homes in our region.
With no transportation alternatives. And,
right.
and I mean, I've been reading in the last few weeks some been part of a discussion about car sharing mm-hmm. and the potential for car sharing to be more or widely used as a public transportation alternative, which raises obviously some issues about who has access to it. And but those are things that people are trying to address. And it does begin to open the door to some of the conversations about suddenly opens the door to some of the conversation about density, because it takes off the table the sort of the mantra, the traffic mantra.
Right.
And I find that very exciting, because it is near. It's actually a close, you know, something that could actually happen fairly quickly, but what its costs are, I don't think everybody has weighed in on it, but it does offer the opportunity to say that is not traffic, then isn't your excuse anymore.
Right.
You know,
right. And then I think, you know, we often have these sort of chicken and egg discussions about housing and density and transportation. But the reality is that if we're going to ever be able to afford any sort of public transit system that's a large scale capacity, we're going to have density to be able to support it. You
right.
have to have a certain level
critical
of
mass.
Ridership,
right.
right, to be able to support public transit. And so we can't kind of yell and call for public transit, but then on one hand oppose density because we need both of
they
those
go hand
things
in hand
together.
Yeah. Well, and we've really reached a tipping point. I mean, we've certainly heard it all through the campaign from every corner, regardless of which candidate they were during the mayoral campaign I'm talking about. Yeah. God forbid that we talk about anything else. But it was, it came from every quarter, you know, from business people, from, you know, you name it. They were saying, you know, there's transportation problems and there's housing problems. And really, you know, the history certainly hasn't been kind to us. I mean, this is, like I said, and we've noted this has been going on for a long time. And the state, you know, since 2008, I mean, the money's been cheap, but our state has refused to use that opportunity to make some investments. And then there's some legal things that kind of tie the hands of the municipalities to be able to do, to be able to actually have some tools at their disposal to help encourage these things to happen. Maybe you want to give us a little insight into the kind of conundrum that we find ourselves in terms of what the local government might even be able to do to incentivize larger, more numerous. I mean, just beyond the kind of public backlash against density, but it's almost like there's not even something that the local government has available to them, or we need to make sure they do.
Right. So in order to have a critical mass or to create a critical mass of housing, it's traditionally been done one of two ways, either voluntarily or by some mandate. So either the carrot approach or the stick. And in South Carolina, based on South Carolina law, we can only use sort of the carrot approach. So development of a certain size, negotiate a development agreement with the local government, and within that development agreement, the local government can say, I will offer you these incentives, you know, additional density, relaxed parking restrictions, you know, variances right. and setbacks in exchange for you providing additional housing units that are going to be affordable to our workforce or at a lower income. And so that's sort of how the process works today. Well, generally, there's somewhat, as you say, a tipping point there that if the government kind of says, well, we want, you know, one half of your units to be affordable or, you know, 30%, where there's a lot of pushback in that sort of negotiation. So we'll see maybe, you know, 10% of the units or 15%, which is just not creating enough. And so if you say, well, that tool's not working, or if you give the ability to say, well, I'm not going to create any, but I'm just going to pay this fee over here and let somebody else do it. But nobody else is doing it. So you're collecting fees, but the housing units aren't doing. Then your other option is to create sort of what we would call mandatory inclusionary zoning. But the South Carolina state, you know, we're a state, we're home rule. And so unless it explicitly says that you can do it, you have to have enabling legislation that would allow local governments the authority to create an ordinance that says, hey, if you're going to build housing in this corridor here, we're going to mandate that X number or X percentage of those units have to be units that are affordable at a certain price point. And that doesn't exist in South Carolina today.
And, so and needs to.
It does. I mean, we are at that point, and I tell people that all we have to do is look at San Francisco and look at what's happening in San Francisco, look at the price points that are in San Francisco. And if you look at the national data, we are headed there. Right. All of the indicators are there that if we continue on the same track that we are on today, that 5-10 years from now, we are going to be at those price points. And it's to me, the most critical economic development issue for our region, both in terms of recruitment, both in terms of our sort of current economy and what it's based on. the long-term viability of local community-based businesses. You know, if people simply cannot afford to live
right
in our region, or people are driving in from Orangeburg or Georgetown to come to Charleston just to work, it's just unsustainable, you know, and unlike a lot of other places, you know, we're landlocked. You know, there's a lot of sort of environmental issues on top of sort of everything else that we have to address. And I think ultimately we have to say, what do we have control over? And, you know,
and what's the value of that? I mean, you know, what is the value of these, you know, different types of people being, you know, part of the community, and basically placing a value on that whole, on what it takes to make the city operate, and to create economic opportunities for at all different kinds of levels, and I think we have blinders on, you know, to it. It certainly seems like we functioned with blinders on that the only thing that really matters is making sure that we have luxury housing here, you know,
and hotels
and hotels. So now, yeah, now it's hotels and luxury housing, regardless of whether the people live there or not. And I mean, I've read recently about, you know, posh neighborhoods in London, for instance, where restaurants that had been there for years and written up in the, you know, gotten all the accolades and so forth, just have to close down because the people are not there often enough who've bought the houses in the nearby. in their neighborhood. So it's a slippery slope.
It is,
you know. And so those, I guess, are some of those real implications about preserving. You know, we talk about preservation a lot, and historic preservation, but the reality is we also should be talking about community preservation, and preserving kind of the cultures and really what makes the our lives here rich and thriving and the potential for that for everybody who's living here.
Yeah, you know, it really is about preservation of people, you know, and, you know, for me personally, you know, my paternal grandparents lived on Bogart Street and my maternal grandparents lived on Poinsett Street, you know, and now when I go to either of those streets, there's no one there who looks like me.
Right.
You know, and so my children's children will never be able to sort of know and experience the Charleston that I knew growing up.
Right.
And being able to come and visit for, you know, during the summers here. And I think that there's a value there. And I think that there's something that a sense of community that's being lost there.
Right.
And it's like, are we committed to sort of preserving that sort of holistic character of Charleston and what has made Charleston unique? And I, you know, I see it oftentimes, we're seeing it, I think, often on the peninsula with African-American churches are struggling.
Right.
Because their congregations are no longer able to live on the peninsula. And so you have churches who are having to make hard decisions about, do we stay here,
right,
you know, or do we go where our members have moved? And I think that there will be a loss of a sense of character on the peninsula if that happens.
Well, and it's certainly, I mean, I remember there's a church at the corner of Charlotte and is it Alexander?
Mm-hmm.
That is quite beautiful. And I know that there have been several occasions where it's come up, you know, where can they rent it or can they use it, be used for other things during the week? And the neighborhoods have been just very resistant to that sort of thing. And, you know, the ultimatum, you know, the what the alternative is really, incredibly unfortunate. And it's a strangulation really of what a meaningful kind of coexistence amongst us all is all about. And so, I guess, you know, there seems to be a tone deafness in the population, that people people kind of turn their backs. They don't, you know, it's you know, we hear it all the time about, oh, life, you know, what life was like, you know, in the years ago, the good old days and that kind of thing. You don't want to probe too much into what that might mean, but
make America great again. No, but you know, oftentimes when something does not affect you directly, and so sometimes I think that there are things that happen that are intentional, but then I often think that there are a lot of times things that happen in the community that are unintentional.
Right.
And I think it's because people aren't paying attention.
Oh, that's
you know?
Sure.
And
sure.
So I don't think that there's some sort of massive conspiracy to sort of gentrify, you know, the peninsula.
Right.
You know, I don't believe that there is, but I do think that people sort of, we all sort of operate in our bubbles in, you know, our sort of world. And so if my world seems great and everything's going along the way I should, it's hard sometimes to sort of step out of that and say, right. and look around and say, hey, wait a minute, something is happening here that I need to pay attention because there's a value that's being lost that if I don't pay attention, I'm going to wake up one day and say, hey, this is a very different place and maybe not a place I recognize or a place that I want to be anymore.
Right. Right. Well, and I know that it seems to be, the sand seems to be shifting, you know, as we speak. It's kind of hard to get reins on it, I think. And I suppose, you know, are there relationships and partnerships, that have been effective in other places that could inform some of these discussions, you know, to sort of illustrate to people who live here either the implications of what doing nothing. I mean, you mentioned San Francisco. Some people would say, oh, San Francisco is great, you know. Right. But there, you know, the kinds of you know, what are some things that we can look to basically have a good sort of picture of the implications. I mean, and maybe you need to be a little more specific as far as San Francisco goes, because, you know,
So one thing I could say, and, you know, I think that this is very sort of top of mind and a big concern of mine is that, you know, come November, we're having this vote on this bond referendum, $1.2 billion
right.
or something dollars. If you look around the country, and every other sort of major city that's grappling with transportation issues, and you talk to, you know, and reach out and talk to those officials, most of them have included as part of that investment some investment in housing. Almost without fail, they will all tell you we should have invested more.
Right.
And this notion that we can invest in transportation alone without a simultaneous and sort of equal investment in housing and think that we're going to solve transportation issues
right.
is simply false. You know, cities are either growing or they're dying. We're a growing city. You know, 40 some odd people are moving here every day. So if we spend 1.2 or however many billion dollars on just transportation
right.
problems, but we have 200, you know, the estimate is another 250,000 or so people or 300,000 because we're going to be at 1 million
right.
people in the region. What are we doing to address where those additional people are going to live, how they're going to live, what impact that's going to have on transportation.
Right.
And so I think that I see it as a missed opportunity. And right. the fact that we're having these singular discussions about transportation, and not talking about housing, not talking about what can we do to shift our community from solely being auto dependent.
Right.
You know, we say we want to be, you know, you know, when we do our economic development scorecard, we talk about leapfrogging, that we're no longer sort of this national city, that we're this international city. But if you think about other great international cities, you know, they have a strong sort of bike path and sort of, you know, bike connections through those cities. They have public transit. They have walking. You know, they're not solely, you know, they have mass transit. They're not solely dependent on automobiles. And we are making all of our decisions as a community at a significant cost,
right,
to the community, solely based on making it easy for people to drive around in cars.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I have an office. Our office is on Upper King Street, and where some of these hotels have come online, and we see a lot of tourists, and a lot of tourists are walking around looking for something, you know, and they'll ask a question, and you'll say, oh, well, it's about five blocks that way, and you get this kind of glazed look, you know, of, and I said, well, there's the Dash bus. I'm not exactly sure where it goes. And they're really, I mean, even if you were to just say, even if you were to accept only the tourist side of things, they're even looking right for ways to move around the city and, that are not in a car, because they're looking around seeing being in a car as a disaster. And I think part of the reason why they come here is that it's a place that you should be able to walk around or get around by other means. And so I think there's the city council, the county council, the COG, the various and sundry kind of governing bodies that are sort of dealing with this whole transportation issue, you know, they're not even on the ground. You know, they're obviously in a car by themselves somewhere.
And I'm a firm believer that we have sort of the ability to make and sort of create the place that we want to live in. And so that if enough people, I say this wherever I go, enough young people, because ultimately, right, wrong, or indifferent, the leadership now is going to go away someday. And so I don't think that we should make decisions today for what we want it to be,
right,
sort of 20 or 30 years from now. And I really think that young people have to use their voices to say, this is the kind of city that I want to see and that I want to create. You know, my first place of my own, I lived in an efficiency apartment in Arlington, Virginia. I did not own a car. I walked everywhere, or I got on mass transit, and probably, you know, was the healthiest I probably was in my life. But, you know, just a freeing from an economic standpoint, from a sort of household, you know, I could pay higher rent because I didn't also have
exactly
an auto. And I think that, you know,
I did the same thing in Washington.
Young people just have to be very vocal about kind of exercising their power with their voice and their vote to say, we want something different.
Right.
You know, that we don't want sort of the same kind of single family home. You know, maybe some people do, but what we're hearing is that an overwhelming majority of, you know, they're waiting later to get married. You know, they don't want to be tied to a mortgage or a big place. Or if they do, they don't want it to be sort of 2,800 square feet, two stories, four bedrooms, two bath, you know, but give me a space, someplace where I can lay my head. But I want to be outside. I want to be able to walk to the park. I want to be able to go to a restaurant. I want to be able to interact with other people. But we're not creating that sense. And we have the power to create that if that's what we want.
I mean, it stands to reason that some of this is driven by these are largely an entire population whose relationship to computers and to technology. I mean, my daughter, your children are obviously much more tied to those things than we could even imagine when we were children. And they are starved for social interaction sort of beyond that. And, you know, the flip side of it, what they want are places where they can interact.
Right.
And I can certainly see that as my daughter ages and getting ready to go to college and all those kinds of things. So I think the reality is that that's, it doesn't have to feel like a threat. Right. And all of these issues seem to get politicized in some way. I mean, you know, the transportation, there's talk about a bike lane and it's suddenly politicized as, oh, well, I won't be able to get to the hospital if I need to because you've closed one lane of the bridge. I mean, the talk of building 526, a $1 billion road through a rural landscape, you know, for in case there's a hurricane so that the people who live on Kiowa Island can get off of Kiowa Island. I mean, what we're talking about, there's a level in which it seems absurd.
Yes.
And the real threat to our existence is not talking about the people and not talking about what it is that the people want. It doesn't have to be, Charleston is already unique and has a unique opportunity to kind of build on that uniqueness. And, there has to be a way to communicate that it's not a threat. And
I think realization of the fact that we don't have the ability to stop at a place in time.
Right.
You know, we don't have that luxury. We can't say, hey, time out, and then we're all going to stop, and then all this stuff is going to happen around us, and then we start back up.
Right.
You know, that's never going to happen. It's constantly sort of changing and evolving sort of system, and that at the heart of that is people.
Right.
And at the heart of that is we got to house those people. And so how do we think strategically, smartly about that? How do we invest wisely? How do we leverage our ability to make smart investments in housing that are going to impact transportation or right. education or...
So that we're making all those decisions simultaneously.
Right.
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 Together. Because
yeah.
if we... I mean, we talk about it as siloed is the big conversation. So if we can talk about those things simultaneously and as having a symbiotic relationship, I guess. This is obviously, I mean, you know, we've got, you know, every topic seems to sort of, you know, somebody sort of sits on the outside and says, no, no, no. You know, I mean, we've kind of come to that. We've allowed ourselves to become so removed from the arena of conversation and compromise and a willingness to listen that it's really a challenge. I mean, it's a really challenging time, but it's a, but, you know, I'm hopeful.
I'm hopeful most days.
Well, so how are we on time? Let's say we're, this is a huge topic. And Michelle, you've really just kind of skated across the top but some people haven't even heard that skating. And I think that's terribly important. But I have a question that I always ask, and in fact, I asked this question to Jeremy Rutledge, and I asked him. I said, Jeremy, if what would you do if you were mayor? And he said, well, I would call Michelle Mapp. So now the real challenge is for you to have a follow up.
Awesome. So thanks, Jeremy, for that. You know, I really do think that. There's no better example than an example. And so if I were mayor, and I've been talking about this a lot lately, I would do a bond referendum for housing. that I think that that's our single greatest opportunity to sort of put our money where our mouth is and say, if we had a pool of capital and that we could direct that capital in a targeted, focused way to create mixed income, mixed use, very diverse, walkable, bikeable communities, why won't we? You know, if we can imagine and contemplate spending $1.2 billion on roads and green space, why can't we think about what $1.2 billion would look like if we invested that as a community into housing? We can control where we want that to happen. It doesn't have to happen everywhere, but right. we can say, this is our urban core. This is where we potentially could have transit, where there exists a line for transit. So let's think about what would that visually look like to build housing around, and then do it. Do it. And it's not, I think the luxury of housing, like so many other things, is that you get a return on that investment.
Right.
You get a return on that investment. And so to me, there's no greater use of potentially public dollars or public finance mechanisms than to say, let's figure out how we can create a pool of capital, how we can decide where we can live with higher density, where we can live with less parking, where we can promote other modes of transportation. And then let's go do it. Let's try it. If we got to crawl before we walk, let's do it on a small scale. But I think we have, you know, I think we have the intelligence. I think we have the capacity. I think we have the know-how. I think we have the will. I think we have great architects. I think we have what we need to create what we want. I don't know why there's an unwillingness for us to simply do it.
Right. Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm not going to go down that hole. But I just, you know, I think you're right. I mean, but it has to be, you know, we know that if we spend $1 billion on a road in 2 more years or 5 more years or 10 more years, we're going to be saying, well, that's not doing the job
right.
that we expected or wanted it to. Unless Uber does, or these, or auto, you know, the driverless car thing takes off, driverless
right.
buses, then all bets are off.
Right.
But I just want to thank you so much, Michelle, for being with us today. I know we've come to realize that investment in community really begins with engagement, and I'm glad you're here, that there are ways to engage on this topic. The South Carolina Community Loan Fund is one of the co-sponsors of the College of Charleston's Race and Social Justice Initiative speaker series. And coming up on October 18th is the National Book Award winning author. I think he won a MacArthur Prize
yes,
too, right?
Yes.
Ta-Nehisi Coates. and you have a Thought Leader Series speaker series. And this fall's speaker is going to be former Mayor Joseph P. Riley Jr., and that's on November 1st.
15th.
Oh, the 15th, sorry.
Yes.
I'm glad I asked. So you're really busy. It's a busy fall. It's always a busy fall. And we kind of like for fall to get here.
Yes.
It's been kind of a warm summer and a warm early-ish, fallish kind of period. But that's going to wrap our conversation, and I just can't tell you how glad I am to have you here today. And again, we invite those of you who've been listening to go online to our Facebook page, and you can submit your questions, feedback, and ideas for this segment. We do post these programs to our website at ifyouweremayor.com if you need a refresher. We can actually make a transcript of this for anyone who may like a transcript. You'll need to email us at info@ifyouweremayor.com. And next week, you can tune in to Small Talks, Big Ideas for your chance to hear from Lowcountry Local First. Thank you for tuning in to 96.3 FM Ohm Radio Charleston and supporting your local nonprofit radio station. If You Were Mayor, we'll be back in about a month for another deep dive into the Charleston region. Thanks.